So if you don't know what to make of this, then we will not relate.
Good evening, everybody. If everybody could take a minute to just get situated, we're going to start in a minute. Thank you. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group Thursday Night's Alcoholic and God Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Patrick. I just want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Before we get started, we're going to have a two-minute silent meditation. So if you can, take a minute to silence your cell phones or any other noise-making devices. And we take a two-minute meditation here to get connected to God, let the craziness of our day kind of drift away. I've kind of been personally been blessed with a very full life. Good stuff goes on throughout the day. We're very busy, and we just take a minute to kind of get situated. So we're going to have the lights go down and just take 2 minutes. I'll see you in a couple minutes. Thank you. And if you'd like to join me in the fog light prayer, God, let your love shine through me like a fog light. For those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Amen. There is a solution from the big book. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Lisa to come up and read Spiritual Experience. It's out of the big book as well. And the reason we read that is the entire purpose of the 12 steps is to have a spiritual experience sufficient enough to recover from alcoholism. So we do think it's important that we understand what a spiritual experience is. If you can help me welcome Lisa.
I didn't know I was first. I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety. Because they develop slowly over a period of time, quite often friends of the newcomer are aware of this difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change would hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most empathetically, we wish to say that an alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or a belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of a program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is a contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thank you, Lisa. So we're going to get started now and introduce our speaker. Before we do, if you guys haven't already, just please try to refrain from getting up and having side conversations coming in and out. Make sure that your cell phones are off so that we don't interrupt our speaker. And with that, personally, it's an honor for me to introduce Russell. I've been around here a couple years only, and I've been hearing him from day one, and as he said to us a couple of weeks ago, there's just certain people in here that are playing a different game, and I recognize that in him from day one. I know for myself, my ears are wide open. My friends and I go out to eat afterwards. We're talking about you. I'm plagiarized things you've said already, and since I've been speaking, I just get very excited to come to this meeting. And with that, please help me introduce Russell.
You're welcome. Oh, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's very kind of you. Put this down. I got this. Okay, that's cool. Let me just get this thing. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981. And I think I'm going to stick on primarily, this is like the fourth deal, so we're sort of like around the fourth step or so, but let me find, I'm going to stick around page 62, one of my favorite pages. It's really good to be here. I got to, how long have I sponsored you, James? 6.5 years. So as soon as I came in, you know, I don't really plan a whole lot of what I'm going to say, but I sort of have a general idea. So I, as soon as I came in, I saw James coming at me because I saw that look on his face. That look, I could tell what was going through his mind, that he immediately realized, as he often does, that I couldn't wait to hear his problems. And he's got some problems. He wants to talk to me about them, and he knows that I'm excited to hear them. And you suffer from that delusion. It's a good one that, you know, your sponsor actually gives a shit. But in any event, And so he told me about his problems. And it is true. I like listening to James because, you know, especially when he's in a tortured position, because somehow it amuses me. It's interesting. But in any event, so we're going to talk about freedom tonight. I'm going to tell you about the third story. You guys ever hear about the third story? You got to know about the third story, because if you don't know about the third story, you'll never get to the fourth story. Most people spend their lives on the first story. Most people, there's a line in the novel that says most people live a life of quiet desperation, thumb-sucking crybabies, you know. So, you know, you got the first story, you got the second story, you got the third story, and then you got the fourth story, which we may be able to get to the fourth story. Maybe not. If not, I'll cover it next week. But, was that for me? Oh. But in order to get to the third story, I got to tell you about the third or the fourth story. I got to go into the first story. It says our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, so I'm going to tell you some stories. So let me read a couple of things. And here's what we're going to make believe. I want you to suspend your brain, if that's possible. You could probably do that for an hour. Then do it for a half an hour. Suspend your thinking. I'm going to suggest something to you. Which isn't such a hard thing to do. I had to do it. You have to learn how to do it if you want emotional sobriety. You know, we all have physical sobriety. If you want emotional sobriety, you have to learn how to do this. Make believe that you don't know anything. Just sort of make believe you don't know anything. Now, every once in a while, a thought may intrude. You know, just bang down that thought. Just, you know, realize that it's even if you think you're right, you're wrong. And this is what we're all going to make believe. We're going to all make believe that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is right, okay? Now, I'll tell you a little bit of a history of this deal. A started in 1935. The Big Book was written in 1939. And they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. In the Big Book, they say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, their path between 1935 and 1939 was not reading the Big Book. You all understand that, right? Because it didn't exist. They read the Holy Bible. And the three, which was written thousands and thousands of years ago, I mean Old and New Testament, but the three books that they found were absolutely essential. Everything I'm telling you is in our literature. The three books they found absolutely essential is 1 Corinthians 13, which is the love chapter, which is, you could spend years just on that. Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6, and 7, which you could spend years on that, studying that. With the Beatitudes, blessed are those, you know, hunger and thirst after righteousness, and the book of James. We were almost called the James Club. So this book really is a compilation of thoughts if they studied the Holy Bible for 4 years. So it's really, what's going on here is thousands of years old. Bill Wilson's the first one who says, I didn't invent this thing. He sort of like Americanized it. He sort of like took all the thoughts and everything that they learned from spiritual and biblical readings and studies and everything like that that were working for them, and he sort of put it in sort of like a language that we could sort of understand and grasp. But the concepts are as old as time. I mean, you could find them in Ecclesiastes. You find them. The concepts are all there. And what I want to try to sort of somehow piece together for you here is, you see, we're all sober here, but if you're alcoholics and you're somewhat like me, and, you know, most, this is our basic text. This is the text we all agree on, supposedly. This is like Obamacare in a sense. You know, we got to pass it in order to find out what's in it. You know what I mean? Well, you know, you say we agree on. You say, oh yeah, I'm a big book guy. We agree on the big book. But the problem is 90% of the people that are in AA that agree on the big book don't even know what's in here, because if they knew what was in here, they'd really be pissed off. You know, because it says a whole lot of things. But I'm going to say this. I'm going to tell you to make believe that this legitimately really is the deal. It says a lot of, it says stuff about you. I mean, this isn't me telling you about you. This is the book telling you. I'll tell you. You know what it says? Let me tell you. It says your chief characteristic is defiance. It says your number one characteristic is defiance in 12 and 12. That's number one. So in other words, it says you guys are defiant sons of a bitches. You're arrogant, defiant. Now, listen. Now, personally, I know that's bullshit. You understand what I'm saying? I know that's total horseshit. You don't understand. You know, I'm different. I'm a nice guy and everything. But I'm just telling. I mean, I know that. I know it's bullshit. I know that the truth is you really don't understand what I've been through. and how I've always tried to do the right thing, and I've tried to be a nice guy, but because of bad breaks and misunderstandings, if you only knew how many times I tried to make it right and I got screwed and everything like that. So I know you have an excuse and it's not your fault in anything, but I've just got to tell you, the big book says you're pretty much assholes. You understand what I'm saying? So it's a tough pill to swallow, okay? But I want you to, we're going to make believe that we're really big book thumpers, and we're like going to set our mind aside. See, this is the scary thing. If you stay sober for 20, 30 years and you work this thing, you begin to see that they're right and you're wrong. So I've got, what I've got to do, because I got some guys who are like 1 month sober and, you know, a year sober and whatever, and they don't necessarily buy into all this stuff. You know what I mean? So what we're going to do, at least go with me, make believe that this thing is legitimate. It's been around for many years. Millions have gotten sober, you know, stayed sober. Let's make believe what they say in here is true. And I'll tell you, it says stuff in here. You know, it says some nice stuff and makes you feel good. You go into the promises. The promises, aren't they great? The promises, you know, no new freedom and new happiness and everything like that. You know, it's almost like, let me buy you a drink. You know, I mean, it's like great stuff. But you know, it also says things. It says you're all selfish and self-centered. That's what it says. It says selfishness, self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our troubles. It's talking about you. It's talking about me. It says driven. It says you're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. It says you're all self-pityaholics. All you're doing is self-seeking and thinking about yourself all the time. It says you're full of fear. It's the corrosive thread. And it says you're delusional. It says you see shit that isn't true. It says what you see in the world that you think is true is totally, absolutely false. That's what the book says about you. But we read past that shit because, you know, they're talking about, they don't understand you like I understand you. We know that's all bullshit. But I said, even though you know what I'm saying is bullshit, we're going to make believe the book is right. This is, by the way, this is the book Alcoholics Anonymous. This is our basic text. The program, Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, was named after this book. This is the book. This is the book that, you know, it says, rarely have I seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. You can't fail if you follow their path. They say, well, you know, you see, if you're going to buy into this, you've got to buy into the fact that you're selfish, you're self-centered, you're full of fear, you're driven by, totally, you're self-delusional. What you think is right is wrong. That's why you got all these old ideas that you got rid of, or the result is nil. I mean, actually, if you understand what it says, really, you're like in bad shape. You don't have a shot, you know? And then it says this. It says, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we find that sometime past we made decisions based upon self, which put us in a position to be hurt. In other words, the reason we got hurt and all stomped on is because we make decisions. No, hey, I don't know about you. Nobody tells me how to run my life. I mean, just try to do that, okay? Nobody tells me what to do. I make decisions based upon self, which put me in the position. I'm my own worst enemy. Weren't we talking about this? We were just talking about this. We were talking about, I remember I had a sponsor named Joe Snyder. He, for 20 years, he worked, 30 years he worked for the post office. For the first 20 years, he complained about working at the post office. All he did was complain about the post office, how bad the post office, how he hates the post office. After 20 years, an old biddy who was working next to him, he said, Joe, can I ask you a question? He says, what? He says, who applied to work at the post office? It was him, you know. I mean, we're the guys who we you know, you start complaining about your husband, your wife. I say, well, do you remember who married her? You know, who picked that gal out? You know what I mean? Who did that deal? You know, it's who decided to do all this stuff? And it says, our troubles we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. Alcohol can self-override, though we usually don't think so. Above everything, we must get rid of the selfishness, because that's what the real disease is, getting rid of selfishness. First of all, we don't even recognize what selfishness looks like, because the truth of the matter is selfishness just looks like us. You look in the mirror, you say, that's selfish. They say, no, that's not selfish. That's just me. You talk about your life and you say, well, that's selfish. No, that's not selfish. That's just my personality. He says, yeah, but you're selfish. You know, I mean, you don't when you're swimming in a soup of selfishness, when all you do is think about yourself, you don't think about yourself as being selfish. It's just the way you are. You know what I mean? And you're a good guy. Of course you're a good guy. Look at all your friends. They think and act just like the way you do. Because I don't know about you. I hung around guys that thought and acted like me. They talked about, you know, I would tell them about this jerk or this idiot or my wife, whatever the heck it is, and they'd say, hey, man, you're right. You know, let me tell you about my wife. You know, I mean, I'm surrounded by a group of people that tell me I'm right, patting me on the back. You know, they're not like sponsors that make fun of me and say, what are you, stupid or something like that. They tell me I'm right. And the people that tell me I'm wrong, well, they're just stupid. You know, they just don't know. So it says above everything, we must get rid of the selfishness we must, or it kills us. It kills us. Even if we're sober, it kills us. We'll either drink again or do something self-destructive. You know, Carl Menninger said in his book, Alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. So we'll somehow destroy ourselves. It says we must get rid of, we must, or it kills us. It says God makes that possible. So to sort of switch this around, so what happens as you get rid of this self? Is there, apparently there's a way of, after you get rid of the booze, apparently now you got to deal with something we call selfishness. So how do you get rid of this selfishness? What does it look like, and how do you get, you, even if you see it, if you only say, man, I am one selfish son of a bitch. You know, and there's a lot of, it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, there are consequences to being an alcoholic. There are consequences to being a human being. Unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious. Of true happiness, he'll find none at all. So if you want true happiness, you got to figure out what the consequences are of your alcoholism. What are the consequences? There are consequences to being an alcoholic. You may not even, you know, when you do say that crap about, when you do have those tapes running, and every once in a while they come up to your conscious level and you hear them, you're an asshole, you're stupid. When you are constantly saying bad shit about yourself and judging yourself and comparing your insides with other people, you understand, and saying, you know, when you're constantly talking bad to yourself or saying crap like that, or, you know, when you're constantly restless, irritable, and discontented, unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking it. What does it mean to be discontented? Like, why? Okay, I understand. I can't drink. I have an allergy to drinking. But why do I feel like a piece of shit sometimes? Why sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad? Why do I have all these bad thoughts about myself and other? I mean, how do you get rid of all that other stuff? You know, I'm chasing, I'm running, I don't even know what I'm chasing for, and I'm not even sure. How do you get rid of all the confusion, all the mind? How do you get rid of all those thoughts? The committee. How do you get rid of everything else that goes along with your alcoholism? Let's talk about your thought life. Why do you think the way you do? Why do you say the crap you do? Why do you do the stuff you do? I mean, forget about the drinking. What the hell is going on with you? You know what I mean? You're not walking promises here, you know? It's a struggle. It's a trudge. It's a horror story. What is that all about? When are you going to be free? When are you going to feel good about yourself? When are you going to be free of all this I need, I want, I have to have, what's going to happen to me? You know, up at three, the fear. When do you get rid of the fear, the anxiety, the worry? How is that all connected with selfishness? What happens as you lose selfishness? Well, maybe as you lose selfishness, you know what it says in the book? It says, once we sincerely take this position, trusting and relying upon God, all sorts of remarkable things happen. It says, being all-powerful, he gives us everything we need if we stay close to him and perform his works well. Staying close to him, but it says it talks about how we lose concern for our little plans of design. We start thinking about how we can help others, and all sorts of stuff flows from that, and things like that. And somehow this deal we're working on is somehow connected. Is somehow the whole thing that makes it happen, that psychic change that Dr. Jung talked about, where ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which are the motivating factors of these men's lives, are suddenly cast to one side. They become motivated by a whole different array of ideas, emotions, and attitudes. That psychic change, that new creation, that we are reborn, it says in the book, into different people. It's like turning off your computer that has the virus. Your computer's all screwed up. You turn it off. You kill it. You turn it back on. It's working okay. How do you kill yourself and kill all that stuff and get rid of it and all of a sudden become that new person that can live free in the world without all those bad thoughts about other people? I mean, the drinking is pretty much the easy. I mean, listen, everybody's got to drink their last drink. You can't rob an alcoholic of desperation. And unfortunately, some people will never drink their last drink. They'll just die. But but the bottom line is everybody's going to drink their last drink, but there's a difference between coming in here and drinking your last drink and having your last think. You know, how do you get rid of the think? And that's why people go to, that's why a lot of people come to meetings like that to say, well, maybe this guy will say something to me so that I won't have to think the way I think and act the way I act and be the way I am and worry about it. Because I'm just a jumble of worries and stuff like that. So how is that all connected with the God thing and the selfishness thing? And the inventory thing. You know, I told you I have a sign in my office. I'm a lawyer. It says the truth, you can't handle the truth. Because people come into my office, you know, intelligent people in horrible jams, you know. And they say, let me tell you my problem. And they tell me a problem. And it starts off with, it's not my fault. I'm not to blame. I didn't do it. You don't understand. And they tell me this crazy, crazy story. And I say to him something like, well, did you tell the cops that? And they say, yeah. I said, what did they do? He says, they arrested me. I said, well, that may not be, you know, you may be wrong about that story. We may have to regroup, you know, because they see it the way they see it, you know, and they are the way they are. And, you know, it's, so how do you get paid? So when you've thought about yourself a certain way, you thought about life a certain way, and maybe you're wrong. Maybe you just see the things, maybe you just see it the way you want to see it. You know, maybe that's the deal. So how does that, all that stuff have to do with having this change? Now that I said that, now I'm going to bring you back to Matthew chapter 6, okay? Now I feel okay about talking about this because, number one, I have, it'll be 34 years in January, if I make it. And so I stopped worrying about 10 years ago about whether or not I can be kicked out of AA. So I say things like Jesus, Bible, stuff like that, because unlike most people who get up on the podium and say God and sort of like apologize for mentioning that. You know what I mean? I know that I know what the big book says. It says there's one who has all power, that one is God, may you find him now. It says we never apologize for God. I know this whole thing is about God. So rather than a person who still has that fear of whether people like him, has that fear about whether people will talk about him behind their back, has that fear of like, what are they thinking about me? What are they talking about me? Along with that delusion, thinking that everybody's thinking and talking about him, you know what I mean, all the time. Well, nobody really gives a shit, you know what I mean? But we think they do because that's part and parcel of the disease of selfishness and self-centeredness. Rather than have that, one of the things that is removed, that God removes, is that concept of worrying about what people think about you, and that means you can be yourself and talk about what you really feel inside without running it through the filter of, will they like me if I say this or not? And you can be your own man, which relieves a whole lot of fears and worries on the planet, you know what I mean? You can spend a lot of time. Ecclesiastes, you know, King Solomon said, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It's all about who am I, what do I look like, and what are they going to think? And that helps you live your life a lot freer. You know, I only wish I could have done this when I was 18. You know, I mean, it feels great at 66. You know, understand what I'm saying? Man, if I could only have had this in my pocket at 22, you know, maybe I wouldn't have drank so much, worrying about what that gal was thinking about me, what the guys were thinking. If I could only, man. It's just born too late. What can I tell you? You know what I mean? It just took a long time. But thank God I got it. Some people go to their grave and they never get it. So how is that all that deal related? So then we go back to Matthew, the book of Matthew. And it has a lot to do with the fourth and the fifth step and things like that, and eight and nine and stuff like that. And in the book of Matthew, which is the only sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, which was the major thing that they used, okay? And when I came in here, they gave me a book. Called Sermon on the Mount. Told me to read it, you know, and I read it. They, you know, they weren't scared of the Bible or anything like that. And there was a line there in the sermon, and the line said this. It says, now you understand we have a thing called the 11th step. I'm going to bounce around with steps because that's the way I am. You know, when I first came into AA, it was all about step one, then step two, then step three, then step four, doing it formally, trying to figure them out because each step, you know, and everything was, it was so new and so different. Every time I did anything, it was like, oh, that's a step three. Oh, I think that's a step 10. Oh, I think I did a step five, you know. But, you know, after you start living your life, it becomes part of your life, becomes second nature, and you're doing it all the time. They're like all mushed together in one thing. They're not discrete little things. It's just the way you live your life. You know, say, because you find out there's a lot of step three and step eight. There's a lot of step four and step nine. You know, it's all mushed in together. It all becomes part of your thinking and the way you are and the aspects of your personality. And so you can't really separate them, you know. And so one of the things that you realize is that in step 11, if you're really looking at what's going on, this whole thing ultimately leads you finally to the last real step, in a sense, is step 11, which is once you have a conscious relationship with God, which is the one that's going to change you all, you just keep on improving that relationship. That it's God that you're not going to do the change. Well, how would you do the change? You're ready for this? We're in AA, right? Listen to me. You know what step one says? It says you're powerless to do the change. You know what chapter of the agnostic says? That's a chapter to people that don't believe in God. The chapter says get over that. It says if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life would have helped us, we would have gotten better a long time ago. If we could have helped ourselves, we would have gotten better. We wouldn't be here. But it wasn't enough. We were powerless. We had to find a power greater than ourselves, which would solve your problem. And that's why we talk about God. So you see, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it does take a stand. We're not agnostics. We're not atheists. As a matter of fact, Dr. Bob says, in his final story back here, if you're an agnostic or atheist, have any other form of intellectual pride that keeps you from understanding what's happening here, I feel sorry for you. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down. So in AA, make no mistake about it, we're deists. We believe in God. Alcoholics Anonymous believes in God. It takes a stand, okay? I don't care. I'm not going to argue with anybody about it. You do whatever you want to do, but the book takes a stand. There's one chapter to non-believers. It's called Chapter of the Agnostics. It says, get over it. This is what we do. This is our deal, okay? We believe in God. We're not going to tell you what religion to belong to, but that's the deal. And that's the thing that's going to lift you. So what happens is, when you get to step 11, because you want this change, you know, the change they talk about in step 6, right? What's the step that separates the men from the boys? That's step 6. It says, the test for it is who grows in the image, who wants to grow, repeatedly does these things, so he'll grow in the image and likeness of his creator, God. It's God, 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 all the way through here. So you finally get to step 11, it says, more God, more God, more God. Step 1, do I have to believe in God? No, don't worry about that shit. We don't believe in God. Don't worry about that stuff. We're closing the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. You know what I mean? Don't believe in that. Step 1, do I have to believe in God? I don't want to believe in God. What is God? Just say the Lord's Prayer. Step 11, right? More God. More God. More. By the time you get to step 11, you're cooked. Hopefully, you're cooked. You know, you're not cooked. You have problems. More God. And then step 12, we tell people about that deal. You understand what I'm saying? Now, you don't have to buy into that stuff. But you don't also have to experience the promises either. You can live your life as a thumb-sucking crybaby, worrying about whether or not you got a girlfriend or a boyfriend or what's going on with your sex life or how big a bank account you have. Or you can live your life physically sober the way you lived your life before you came in here, worrying about the same crap and losing sleep at night and just being an angry son of a gun and continually getting into trouble. You can do that too. You know, you can do it. It has to do with what you want. So how does this deal have to, so how does the fourth step, for instance, how does, and not to mention the fact that we're supposed to be honest, doesn't that say if you have the capacity to be honest, how does living an honest life have anything to do with being an alcoholic? What does that mean? What happens if we, how do all these steps work into making us ready? So here, let me give you a principle. This is a principle. Why do we do these steps? For instance, why does step 4 and 5 have anything to do with step 8 and 9, where we make amends? And what does 4 and 5 have to do with the basis of 8 and 9? And what the hell does that have to do with having a relationship with God in any event? What does it have to do with, what does it have to do with the fact that trying to understand and piece together the causes and conditions and what we did and who we hurt and everything and making amends to them have anything to do with anything about growing and feeling better and believing in God? How does that all? And then you have to go back to the book of Matthew. This is where they got the concept from. Because in the book of Matthew, which is a sermon given by Jesus, what it says in the book of Matthew is, he says, if you come to the altar of God, if you come to worship God, you want to worship me, you want to worship God, you want God to help you, and you realize that your brother has something against you. You screwed him, you did something to him and everything. He says, don't bother coming to me first. You know, you leave your gift at the altar, then go back and you take care of what the problem is with your brother. And then come over to me. You know, he was apparently God. And don't ask me why, because I didn't write. Personally, I think, screw my brother. I got the money. I'm out of here. You know what I mean? But apparently God, and you should be happy about this. This is good news. You should be happy that he's concerned that we don't act like assholes. You understand what I'm saying? Because if we had a God that, you know, wanted us to act like that, it would be big trouble, okay? Personally, I believe that to be true. But so apparently what he wants us is to love. The whole thing's based upon love. That's what the First Corinthians said. He wants us to love each other. Love one another. That's what he wants. He wants us to be a servant. That's why our leaders are trusted servants. He wants us to serve others. I know we're out there to grab and rip and run and get, but that's what he wants. Don't ask me why. I didn't write the book. This is in the book. It's all in the book. It's about love. It's about service. It's about helping other people. That's what the Good Samaritan, you got to be the Good Samaritan every day. You see somebody who's sick or something like that, you help him. You go out and you do service. It's all about other people, being concerned with other people. And so for whatever reason, he says, if you want a relationship with me, you go out and be kind and help other people, and you said right. Well, let me ask you something. Who do you want to have a relationship with? I mean, if you were God, who would you want to have a relationship with? some guy that's ripping, raping, robbing, only gives a shit about himself, but you want to have a relationship with somebody who's a caring person, who loves you and loves other people. And is, you know, who do you, who, what's your deal? Well, the most people I hang out with, when they like people because they seem to be kind and decent, you know, make them feel good when they're with them. Of course, we're alcoholics and we're kind of crazy. We tend to link up with people that tear us down. That's a whole other story that I'll get into it another week or something like that. So in any event, so that's where it all comes from, okay? Somehow, some way, I haven't quite pieced it together, but I know if I forget about myself, help other people, and I can somehow set right what I did wrong and maybe not do a lot of things wrong in the future, somehow I'm able to clear the channels so I see the presence of God come into my life, it becomes stronger, and I can believe more. If, in fact, I don't do that, and I'm constantly screwing other people and hurting other people, and I think I'm not hurting myself. All I do my whole life is sitting around thinking about people in my mind, thinking about what assholes they are, how much I don't like them. I'm going to sleep thinking about people. I'm riddled with guilt, although it doesn't feel like guilt. It feels like hate. You know, my guilt immediately turns into hate. You know, if I hurt you or you make me feel better, something like that, I don't feel guilty for anything I do. I just start hating you for being who you are. You know, so you'll believe me, I've killed more people in my mind, you know, ripped them apart, shot them, you know, shot their kids in front of them, resurrected them, shot them again, and everything like that. I mean, I've murdered more people than Hitler in my mind, you know. I used to drive a car blowing up people and stuff, and still capable of, and that's, you know, if you're an alcoholic, that's the way you live your life, killing, hurting, hating, you know, people. And, you know, something, it's very hard to live a happy, joyous life when you got all that murdering shit on your mind. No, I mean, the government may not know about it. You may not get be arrested for it, but you know about it. You know, I know what it's like to live your life constantly worrying about, you know, whether, you know. I know it's constantly, I know what it's like to constantly check caller ID, you know, to rip up letters before you open them, you know, from, you know. I know what it's like, you know, to say, you know, get the phone and say, who's, I know what it's like to walk into someplace and see a guy or a gal saying there's, oh, shit, I hope he didn't see me, and then walk out. You know, I mean, I know what it's like to walk on the other side. I know what it's like to live your life with all these people on your mind, you know, and you can't live a productive life that way. And I used to think that's just the way life was. I didn't know any other life than worrying about people all the time, you know. And you don't even know you're worried or you're in fear, you know. I have guys come to me and they tell me this. They throw this crap. They vomit this crap out on about all this crap they're going through, what they're worried about, and this one and that one. And I say, well, you're in fear. I see, and they say, no, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm just worried, you know. I mean, so they don't even know. We just bullshit ourselves. Well, like I said last week, we tell ourselves lies. We spend 6 hours worrying about what other people are thinking about us, and then we tell ourselves, I don't give a shit what other people think about me, you know? We just tell ourselves crap, you know, which is untrue. So, now that I went through that, that's actually so I want to get into the story. So what does all that have to do with step four and step five and eight and nine and all that sort of stuff? What is it? So I'm going to tell you a story. This is a true story. I'm going to tell you a true story. I got married when I was, I don't know, 25 or 26, something like that. I'm not sure of dates and times and everything. Long time ago. So I got married to a very nice young lady, and we got married, and we bought a house, and had very nice in-laws and everything like that, and had a son, and it didn't work out. It didn't work out, you know. The truth of the matter is that what I found, I didn't cheat on her or anything like that. Didn't do anything like that, you know. And drinking may have been part of the picture or something. She was really down on the guys I hung out with and, you know, my drinking and everything like that. But I never cheated on her, never did anything like that. I supported the family. And it was just, we were just growing in different directions. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it happens every single day in the United States. Thousands and thousands of people are getting divorced because they get married after 2 or 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, it doesn't work out. Then we just go in a different direction. She didn't understand me. I didn't understand her. She didn't like my lifestyle. I didn't change at all since we got married. She wanted to change me. I didn't like her deal and everything like that. We found her arguing, bickering, and then, you know, so we split, and, you know, I did it the right way. I got a lawyer. She got a lawyer. I paid the child support. I did the deal. I took my kid out. I signed the paper. I did it all the right way. You know what I mean? I was the right guy and a righteous guy, and that was the deal, and, you know, we got divorced, and that's it. I went my way. I took my kid. You know, that's the end of that deal. And then ultimately, after I got sober and everything, I got married again. Now I've been married like 34 and all that sort of stuff. So that's a true story. That's a true story about my life. We married 5 years. It was a short-term marriage. So that's the story. So that's the first story. So let me tell you another story, okay? is another story. So I got married to this gal. She's a very nice gal. And we had a very nice wedding. She had wonderful, wonderful in-laws. And she loved me very much. And I thought I loved her. And I was very happy for a month or two or something like that, however long it was. And I got a job with the state's attorney's office. And I was moving up the ranks there. And we had a kid. And we had a nice house in Miami Beach. And what I used to do is after work all the time, I'd go to the bar. And I would hang out at the bar. I'd go in the bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would drink, and I would come home at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And she'd be at home. This is the way it would work. Let me tell you a typical Friday night. I go into the bar at 4 o'clock, okay, and I'm drinking. And look, I had a tough job. You know, and you guys have a tough job. You know, you got a tough job. And, you know, the only people that really understood me were the other attorneys that were working with me. You understand what I'm saying? My wife didn't understand me. Nobody else understood me. But the other guys who were working with me, well, they had to have two qualifying things. Number one, they had the other prosecutors that were working with me. And number two, they had a drink. You know, I mean, there were probably prosecutors that worked that didn't drink, but I didn't know who they were because we all met at the bar. And so I would meet at the bar, and what would happen is I would drink, start at 4 o'clock, and around 5 o'clock, and my wife was at home fixing dinner with the baby. And about 5 o'clock, she would get a phone call, and I would say, 5 or 6 o'clock, 2 hours later, I'd get a phone call, and I'd say, honey, I just got to the bar, because I was only 15 minutes away. I just got to the bar, which, when you think about it, in geological terms, 2 hours is really like just getting there. You know what I mean? I'd say, I just got to the bar, but I'll be home. I'll be home in a few minutes and everything. I'm talking to so-and-so about a case. I'd say something or whatever it is. Because it was sort of true. I was talking about a case. What I was really doing is looking at all the gals and look at all the excitement, looking at all the fun. Now, I wasn't cheating on my wife. I was just thinking about cheating on my wife. You understand what I'm saying? Because I was already restless because, you know, even though she was a good-looking gal and I liked her very much and all that sort of stuff, you know, after 2 months, it's just another used car. You understand what I'm saying? It's just another car. It's just another car that was fun driving, but, you know, I mean, sure, you're laughing, James. You don't know what it's like. You understand what I'm saying? But it wasn't doing it for me. You know what I mean? Because it is about sex and vanity and wanting and needing and having, and it was all already old for me, you know, after about a year or two. She was just my wife, you know what I mean? But there were some good-looking gals in that bar, you know? But you see, I'm a man of integrity. So I would never cheat on my wife when I was, you know, I know there's some guys that I wouldn't do that, you know. I knew I wouldn't do that. I would just think about it and sit there. And so what happened is I'd say, I'll be right home. And she said, okay, I have dinner here and everything. And then around 8 o'clock, she'd get another phone call. And I'd say, and I could tell she was a little upset. And she'd get another phone call and she'd say, I'd say, listen, I'm sorry, we got caught up in something. Somebody came in, I had to talk about a case, but I'm going to be right home shortly. And she says, okay. And then around 10 o'clock, she'd get a phone call. Of course, the baby's asleep and everything like that. And I'd say, and I could tell she wasn't even talking to me at that time. And I'd say, listen, I'm out the door. I'm out the door. And I was right. I went out the door. I went to another bar. And then I'd come in. At 4 o'clock in the morning. And that was pretty much my life for 5 years with this gal. You know, being married but wishing I was divorced and wanting to screw around anyway. And staying out till 4 o'clock in the morning while they're... And I don't remember anybody taking me aside and saying, Russ, what are you doing? You know, you're 27 years old. You got a wife at home. You got a kid at home. Why don't you grow the hell up and be a man and do what people do, what fathers and husbands do, and go home and be with you? I don't remember anybody saying that. The only thing I remember guys in the bar is talking bad shit about their wife and other people. And that's the only thing I remember. And I thought I was the greatest guy in the world, the most honest, greatest guy in the world, living a life of integrity. You understand what I'm saying? So one day she said to me, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And I tell that story. I walked out the door and I said, what the hell do you mean by that? And then she, you know, that kind of thing. And she was a good gal. She was one of these people that, you know, she really did live a life of integrity. She was one of these people that, you know, I suppose she thought when she got married, like, she really thought, you ready for this, that it was like, till death do we part shit. You know what I mean? She believed in staying married for like a long period of time, forever, and committing yourself to somebody. Who the hell does that crap? You know what I mean? I mean, think about it. I mean, shouldn't you have like a mulligan, like a trial period? You know, I mean, you know, my idea is you link up with somebody. It's like a mulligan. I mean, you try, you do your best, but if a couple of years ain't working out, adios, muchacho. I'm not going to stick around in a, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say this, but I mean, in the back of my mind, I'm sort of thinking, you know, You know, this not drinking thing is okay, but I'm off in about a week from now if it ain't working. For, you know, I'm not going to do anything forever. Guy, I mean, that isn't right. You know, who does that? Who does that? Who commits forever? Really? She was like one of those people that thought it was going to last. I mean, she probably, you know, and so that night I got to the bar and I drank. I came home at 4 o'clock in the morning. That was the end of my marriage. But it wasn't really the end of my marriage. Because even though we're going, because she kicked me out of the house, but as I got to tell you the truth, and this is the truth. I wanted to get a divorce. I felt like I was strapped. I wanted to go out with those gals. I wanted to do that deal. But I was too, but she was a wonderful gal, and I knew she was a wonderful gal. I knew there was no cause for the divorce. I knew her parents were great people, and I loved them. And I felt guilty. I felt guilty about asking for the divorce. So the truth is, I just kept on drinking and drinking. And maybe this wasn't a conscious thought, but it was there somewhere, you know. And when she came, and I was so horrible that I forced her hand to kick me out of the house. So, you know, I could say, it's not my fault she kicked me out of the house. You understand what I'm saying? I had to have her kick me out of the house. So what happened is, because when she kicked me out, and I was walking away of everything that was important to me, my house, my child, my wife, I said to myself, thank you, Jesus, I'm free. I felt free. I could go to the bar. I could hang out with the gals. I was free. Now, let me tell you what happened. About a month later, she thought, because of the way she is, that we ought to go to a marriage counselor and try to patch it up. And I think I might have told you this story. If not, it's embarrassing, but I'll tell you. We go to the marriage counselor. And the marriage counselor does whatever they teach at marriage counselor school. You know what I mean? He goes to my wife. He says, well, what are the three things you would like to change about Russell? And she goes, well, I'd like them to come home for dinner and maybe not drink so much. And whatever the third thing was, who knows? I wasn't listening. Because all I'm thinking in my mind is, I'm like that scene from The Godfather. You know what I mean? Where Al Pacino says, I got out and they pulled me back. I see. This is... Man, I had already made the great escape, you know what I mean? I was like on my way to stardom, you know? Hugh Hefner of Miami, here I come, you know? And they're like pulling me back into this relationship, you know? And let me tell you something, I was about as sober as I am right now, physically, thinking all these thoughts, feeling all these feelings. I mean, you can get rid of the alcoholism. You can get rid of the drinking. How do you get rid of the alcoholism? How do you get rid of that crap? Where you're willing to hurt people and crush people and live a lying, dishonest life, not giving a crap about anybody else and only think about yourself sober, because that's my whole life. Now, if you had told me this is what's going on with me, I would have said you didn't know what you're talking about. But I see myself being pulled back in, and he turns to me and he says, Russell, how do you want to change your wife? And I say, Doctor, I just want to date other women. I notice the gals aren't laughing. I wonder what that feels like when your husband says that. And you got a little child, and you got it home. I didn't think anything of it. I just wanted to blow that thing up and get out of there so I could get to the bars. I did that. I was stone cold sober. I don't need alcohol to be an asshole. Believe me. Most people I heard in my life, I heard cold stone sober in a selfish way. I heard many people in my life after I stopped drinking. You understand what I'm saying? The only thing alcohol allowed me to do is live with my sorry ass self and tell myself I was okay without blowing my brains out. Now, maybe you suffer from a different type of alcoholism where you were just a nice, decent person all the time. You know, so that's my story. And I can tell you a few more things just in case you have any warm feelings about me. You know what I mean? I can tell you a few more things and say, well, what do you think about me now? You understand? Now, let me tell you, see that story I just told you? That's a true story. That's the truth. I just told you the truth. The first story was a true story. The second story is a true story. I lived my life on the first story for years. If you ask me what happened to my marriage, I'd tell you the first story, and I believe it was true. I believe it was true. You know, I didn't even know about the second story. I lived the second story. I was the second story. The second story. Don't tell me about self-delusion. I was the second story, and I didn't even know anything. I didn't know anything about that second story. One day I got sober. One day I started working the steps. One day I started looking at myself. One day I went to A meetings and started listening to other people and their stories. You know, somewhere along the line, if you ask me what happened to my marriage, maybe it was sometime after the fourth step. Maybe it was filled in even more after the fifth step. Maybe it was filled out at six. You know what? Somewhere along the line, I started understanding and believing in the second story. In the second story. I lived the life of the second story. You understand what I'm saying? You know, the second story is an amazing... You know, when you live your life in the second story, you realize who and what you are. You realize how you can hurt people. You realize the amends you make. One day, when I was trying to develop this relationship with God, you know how we're trying to develop this relationship, trying to do this AA thing. I mean, you don't think... Listen, trust me. If you think in the bars or out there on the street or doing the home to work thing or struggling, you think I'm worried about building a relationship with other people or making amends? Are you serious? You know, but when you come into this deal and you got a sponsor and you're doing this deal, you got to do it because it's the deal. So, and I was actually probably like 80% sold on it that maybe it was the right thing to do. So one day, when my first wife was actually going through an operation because they had found some sort of cancer, some sort of deal. It was a serious deal. I went to see her in the hospital, and I made my amends. You know, they say the eighth step is basically based upon what we learned in the fourth step and the fifth step. And I made my amends, and I went up to her, and I explained. And because I knew the second story, see, I understood the second story. And since I understood the second story and I knew the second story, I didn't go up to her and say something stupid like, I'm sorry. You know what I mean? Because I'm sorry doesn't mean anything. Sorry for what? You know what I mean? I'm sorry. I lived my life. Let me tell you something. I'm an alcoholic. If you're an alcoholic, you're a self-pity-aholic. You're a please-love-me-aholic. You're a don't-reject-me-aholic. And let me tell you something. You're an excuse-aholic. And trust me, I'm sorry-aholic. Man, if you're an alcoholic, you know how to. You're a hypocrite-aholic. If you're an alcoholic, I once said to my sponsor once, I don't want to hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer because I don't know whether I believe in God. I don't want to be a hypocrite. He said, too late. You know what I mean? Too late. If a hypocrite is saying one thing and doing it, he says, listen, if you're an alcoholic before you got here, you said I'm sorry 10,000 times. You don't really mean it. It's not the same thing as saying I'm wrong. You're just saying I'm sorry. I'm sorry I have to go through this horse shit of saying I'm sorry. Because the only reason I say I'm sorry is so that you won't feel bad about me and lift the guilt from me. Because if you still feel bad about me, I say, what the hell's wrong with you? I said I was sorry. You know what I mean? You got to immediately snap at it. So you know what happened? But since I was living the second story and I understood, I didn't walk in and say I'm sorry. I said, listen to me. I said to my wife, I said, I just want to let you know. And I mapped out the stuff. And I said, all that stuff I did to you and I did around you, I was wrong. I never said I was wrong. I said I was wrong. I don't know whether anybody's ever wronged you or did something bad to you, how you felt when they come up to you and they just give you that. They just give you that deal. They say, you want to know something? You were right and I was wrong. Man, I'll tell you, when somebody validates you like that and says, listen, you're not crazy. I was wrong. You were right. And I just told her I was wrong. Now, somewhere along the line, you could say I'm sorry or anything, but the point, sorry doesn't work. I was wrong. I was wrong there. I was wrong to do this. You were right to do what you did and blah, blah, blah. And you know what she said to me? This is what she said to me. She said, you know something? I thought I was wrong. I thought I was the failure. Can you imagine that? As a wife, she thought she was the failure. Who knows what goes on in people's minds? She thought she had failed because not having a husband, having her husband leave her like that at her age, after only 5 years with a child, she felt like she was a failure and that she had failed the marriage when I was the guy. You know, I was the only reason, you know. And I said I was wrong. Now, here's the deal. Apparently, according to Matthew, what I read in Matthew, and according to this, now I didn't really piece this together. Apparently, that deal, just doing that deal, cleared away something, some obstruction going on inside of me. They talk about in the fourth step, blocks out the sunshine of the spirit, all sorts of, so that I can have a better relationship with God, which has to do with changing, having that psychic change. and changing me into whatever, whoever the man is I am right now. And that's just one instance of a lot of things. Now, here's the deal. Here's the deal I'm talking about. The third story I told you was the story about me going up to my wife and making that amends. Remember that third story? That third story, which was all so important in order to increase that relationship with God, would have never happened if I didn't have the second story. Do you understand what I'm saying? That story of when I went to the hospital and told my wife I was wrong, you were right, I hurt you, you didn't deserve that, you know, I'm an alcoholic. This is what that story and that amends and the thing I cleared up with my wife between us, so I don't ever have to worry about what my ex-wife feels about, because we're cool, you know what I mean? As I am cool with everybody in my life, really. I don't know anybody has anything against anybody, you know, that story would have never happened with my wife, never cleared up, never had that deal happen, if I didn't have the second story. If I was still living on the first story, well, first of all, I'd probably be drunk or dead, but I certainly would have never apologized to my wife or thought I did anything wrong. And you know where I got the second story? I got it in here, working the fourth step and the fifth step and listening to people and everything like that. So, you know, you need to ask yourself, how many of you people, and how many people are you living in the first story or the second story? I mean, you have a whole concept in your life, like the clients I walk in my office, to what your life is all about, who hurt you, what you did, what they did, you know, all the things that happened to you and how you weren't to blame, or what the story is, or, you know, that you're really not that bad. You were never really that bad. You never hurt. I never hurt anybody. How many times I've heard an, I never hurt anybody except myself. Man, I don't know what kind of drunk you got to be a drunk in Dade County. I mean, the only person only way I know you can hurt nobody except yourself is if you're drinking in the Antarctica. You know what I mean? Never hurt anybody except myself. I mean, all the parents and the grandparents and all the people and, you know, and God, hey, listen, if you're a father and you got kids that are drinking a drug, and you know what kind of pain that's all about, right? And I guarantee your kids have no idea the pain they're causing you, nor do they give a crap, nor do they care. You know, the pain I'm probably caused my mother and my father and those people. And we sit around here having some sort of conception of who we are and what we are, where not only don't we feel bad, you know, the truth is we all have the capacity to be honest, whether you want to call it our conscious. There is something inside of us that sort of blocks out the sunlight, light of the spirit, causes us to live in darkness, and realizes how bad we really are. It's down there. That's where the voices come from. That's where, you know, when you're driving along in the car and all of a sudden you think of something or something wells up and you say, I'm a loser, I might as well kill myself, or whatever the bad shit is you're talking about yourself from time to time that wells out, and you say, where is that coming from? It's coming from your life and that capacity to be honest, who knows who you really are. You can turn on the radio, you can turn on TV, you can text, you can go to the movies, you can do whatever you want to do, get involved in worldly clamors to divert your attention long enough. You can go to Disney World. You can do what this entire world does, running around and do whatever you want to do, make yourself look better, lose weight, whatever you want to do, change the color of your hair. I don't give a crap. So that somehow you divert yourself from what's really going on inside of you. But you know, no matter what color your hair is, no matter how many pounds you lose, you know, the bottom line, you're still going to drive around and hear that voice, you're a piece of shit, you're not good enough, you don't deserve to live. Because changing your hair color, you know, getting a new haircut ain't going to change that. Only for a nanosecond. The vanity only lasts for a nanosecond. You're going to still think you're a piece of crap and unworthy. You're never going to get the new freedom and the new happiness, because that's all an inside job. It's not an outside job. There ain't nothing you can buy at Bloomingdale's or Macy's going to fix that deal. There's no new car that's going to fix that deal. It's just going to cover it up. It's just like booze. It's just going to cover it up for a while. And so that's what the fourth and the fifth, that's what all these steps are really about. It's all about living a life of integrity and righteousness. And saying, no, you can't do that unless you see exactly who you really are. You know, I mean, and you know, and the truth is, I don't even delude myself into thinking that I really see myself as I really am. I mean, I've got like a little glimpse. I know myself a little bit better. You know, I don't even want to think about what God when God sees me. And I know he loves me and everything like that because I have an understanding of who God is and what he is as far as my life is concerned. And he doesn't condemn me. But I know he knows all the crap. I've got like a glimpse of how I can't, you know, I think if I really understood right now how many people I hurt and how I act and how selfish I am, you know, I'm not sure I'd be able to, I'm not sure I'd be able to handle it. I'm not sure. You know, it's tough enough to get in the little glimpses I got. You know, I think, you know, the little glimpses I got. And, you know, I have one of these minds, these alcoholic minds. You know, no matter how many people I hurt, no matter what I do, there's this little part of my mind that is just sitting there waiting with a fire extinguisher to tell me I'm not that bad. It's not my fault. I'm not to blame. They deserved it, the sons of bitches. You know what I mean? I am a rationalizer. I tell myself rational lies. It's part and part. It's a consequence of being an alcoholic. You know, allowing myself to get away with all sorts of stuff. Let me tell you something. As an alcoholic, I don't allow anybody else any leeway. Nobody else. There ain't no probation in my book. You harm me, you wrong me, it's the death penalty. You know what I mean? With me, let me tell you something. I'm constantly laying myself off on probation. You know, I'm constantly letting myself slide, you know. But the truth is, apparently part and parcel of this thing, okay, is actually trying to dissect who and what you are, seeing your selfishness, making those amends, allowing yourself to have a relationship with God, you know, and making that psychic change and doing that deal. So that's the deal with me, and that's you know, and I'm still working this now. I'm working it every day. You're still growing, right? More and more and more growing. Hanging around guys, going to A rooms. Hanging around my sponsors who are 20, 30 years old. The guys I hang around are like in their 80s. They're in their 80s and 90s. You know, I got to hang around those guys so I still feel young. That's, you know, I got to hang around guys who are like, you know, 86, 87 years old, like Pastor Carey. I brought him over here and I have to talk to them because I got to see myself sometimes through their eyes and see who they are. I always got to hang around with people that are farther down the road than me. I got to hang around with people who are new. I really need to hang around with people that are new. That really makes me grateful. You know, I got to tell you, every time I hang around, because I forget. I honestly, you know, you get to a point where things get really good. They get really good. And you forget about being a thumb-sucking crybaby. I need to hang around people. Thank you, James. I need to hang around people. I need to hang around people. I see a new guy. A new guy starts talking about, you know, the stuff that they talk about, you know, all that stuff. And you know, I look and I say, man, I remember when I used to think that way. I remember when I used to say things like, man, I'm having a shitty week. How do you have a crappy week? You know, a guy comes up to me and says, I'm having a terrible day. I want to say to him, I say, including you're talking to me right now, is that included in the terrible day? I mean, and then you ask some questions. I said, well, when you woke up this morning, was it terrible? He says, well, no, it wasn't terrible. Well, by 10 o'clock, was it terrible? He says, no, I went to work. He says, well, by 12 o'clock, was it terrible? He says, no, by 12 o'clock, it was okay. Well, by 3 o'clock, was it terrible? He says, no, 3 o'clock was okay. Well, by 5 o'clock, was it terrible? No, it was okay at 5. I went out to dinner. I saw my wife. Well, at 6 o'clock, was it terrible? He says, no, it wasn't 6 o'clock. So what? Well, while I was over here, some son of a bitch almost ran me off the road and everything like that. He says, oh, he says, yeah, it's good. So I know that you had a bad 5 minutes. He says, well, yeah, it was a bad 5 minutes, but you see, now he knows it's a bad 5 minutes. But when he was thinking about it, because this is a consequence of being an alcoholic, it's like I might as well commit suicide. My life is over. I'm having a bad day. I have alcoholics tell me they had a bad year. They had, because that's the way we think. In our own minds, we exaggerate. We say stuff. That's why we need sponsors to help it, because we don't think straight. We're delusional. Anything bad happens to us, we explode it like it's Hitler, it's genocide. You know? All we do is think about the bad. That's part and parcel of being an alcoholic. Okay, so thank you very much.
Thanks, Nicolette. Thank you, Russell. Everybody, please help us thank Russell. And we're going to bring Nicolette, who helped me up, helped me to do our secretary report.
Hi, everybody. My name's Nicolette. I am your recovered alcoholic secretary. Hi. Thanks. Thank you. Let's see. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I have asked Larry to come up and read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be recovered. It's right here, Larry.
Good evening, everyone. I am Larry, and I am a recovered alcoholic. Recovered, we are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thank you, Larry. Okay, here at this group, we follow the 1940s style Big Book sponsorship from the forward to the second edition. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back into his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I have a show, please, of recovered alcoholics? Great, that's a lot. Anybody here need a sponsor in this room? Nobody? Raise your hand if you do. Okay, I'm going to, should I believe him, Russell? I don't believe you guys, but okay. I'm just going to keep moving. Please join us Monday nights. We meet over in this room for Big Book Study. Fellowship is at 6:30, and Big Book Study is at 7:15. If you should require a big book, we have those for sale for $10. Just see us after the meeting. We meet here every Thursday night, starting promptly at 8:15. We ask that you be courteous and ready to begin. And is James still around? You want to come up, James, because I don't have the info. Okay, James has an announcement. Okay, you guys got that? Mike, are you going to put that on the information? Yeah, Michael put it on the website. Okay, that's it. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
One more time before we close, we all just thank Russell. Thank you. And tonight's meeting was being podcast on Alcoholics and God. So if you want to listen to it again, tell your friends about it, or go back and listen to the first few sessions, you can feel free to do that. I'm sure he'll stick around for a moment if anybody wants to thank Russell. And we also just want to invite you to our Big Book Study meeting on Monday nights, which is in the room right next door. It starts at 7:15, like Nicolette just said. That's a meeting where we go through the book, basically page by page. It's a study group. We do that on Monday nights, and then on Thursdays, we come in here and have the steps presented to us in an experiential way. So we kind of study over there and get a message of hope from very good speakers that we bring in on Thursday night. So if you can, just take one more quick moment of silence, and we'll close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread,
and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.
To recovery, step by step, day by day, I'm on the road. To recovery, trust in God along the way. Trust in God all the way.
Come on, Michael.
There are tears on my pillow that won't dry on their own. Beyond my ears, I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone.
Yeah!
I'm on the road.
On the road.
To recovery, step by step.
Jesus.